Welcome to episode 30 of Primary Care Update, and happy Halloween. We're recording this on October 31st, 2019. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell, a family doc, professor at the University of Georgia, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus. It's an evidence-based online primary care reference. Please check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and the podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. Joining me on this Halloween are Dr. Henry Berry, family physician and one of the founders of Poems, and Dr. Dave Slauson, professor of family medicine at UNC and a founder of Poems. We gave John Hickner the week off. So, Dave, welcome back.
Welcome, Mark. Welcome, Henry. Happy Halloween to both of you.
Yeah, Henry, what's up? Good to have you back on board.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the break. I was moving to our new house, and actually I am sitting in a room in the new house that we may call the conservatory. It's surrounded by windows on three sides, and it juts into the woods, and I'm sitting here watching the deer and the snow. We're expecting, yes, it's Halloween, and we're expecting up to 2 inches of snow. And that's actually appropriate for those of us who are baseball fans who mark the seasons a little differently. When pitchers and catchers report, that's the first day of spring. Opening day is the first day of summer. World Series is fall, and the rest of the year just doesn't matter.
Well, I spent the last few days in D.C., and I got the Nats fever and watched the game last night, which was, I think, the first baseball game I watched all year, but exciting game, and I was happy with the outcome that the Nats won. Sorry, Astros fans, you had your win recently enough. So, Henry, you've got a little study we dug up for Halloween. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was published in the Public Library of Science 1 in January of 2018. So it's an oldie, but it's topical. And this was a multi-year randomized trial that took place on an economics professor's front porch in New Haven, Connecticut. They took over 1,200 trick-or-treaters who were over the age of 3. On average, they were about 8.5, and roughly 50% when they could identify gender because of costumes, about 50% were male. What they did was they randomized patients to the Michelle Obama side of the porch or to a comparison. And what they tried to do is to see which kids selected fruit over candy. And they estimated that seeing the picture of Michelle Obama resulted in 19% more likelihood of choosing fruit over candy. So there you have it. We have some real neat influence of a celebrity who was on a cause celeb, and it seemed to have taken hold at that time. I'd love to see the study repeated now in an era when maybe Michelle Obama is not quite as active.
Putting Donald Trump's image on the, see if that frightens the kids away. I don't know. We'll see. Yeah. Okay. All right. Enough politics, enough Halloween. We're going to talk a little bit about, this is my poem, which is about the new USPSTF recommendations regarding referring women at increased risk of BRCA-related cancer for genetic counseling. Came out in 2019 in JAMA, volume 322, page 652. So this is a summary of the task force recommendation. When I was on the task force from 2012 to 15, I was on the subgroup that looked at this. And so I'm pretty familiar with the recommendation. And this is an update. It hasn't changed a lot, but there's a little more nuance, a little more detail to it. So overall, about 1 in 300 U.S. women carry one of these BRCA 1 or 2 mutations that increase the risk of breast or ovarian cancer. The risk, as we, I think, know, is much higher in women of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. It's about 1 in 40 or 2.5%. This has led to, in Israel, calls for universal screening of women that's being debated. And I also learned, when I was doing a little reading, Ashkenazi is the Yiddish word for Jewish. Or, I'm sorry, for German. And these were Jews in Western Europe, Germany mostly, but also in France, who were chased out of that part of Europe in the 1300s and ended up in Eastern Europe, where they were in Poland, Russia, and other Eastern European countries. And then were, of course, with the pogroms that happened there, chased out or killed and dispersed to the U.S. and other places. And so that's where the Ashkenazi Jewish, we usually associate it with Eastern European descent. So first, there aren't actually any studies randomizing women to screening or no screening. So they had to use an indirect chain of evidence. There's moderate to high quality evidence that some simple risk assessment tools are pretty accurate. These are tools to determine the risk for a BRCA mutation, not general breast cancer risk like the Gale model. If somebody is positive for one of those tools, then the next step is referral for genetic counseling before ordering a test. They found that the genetic counseling led to an increased understanding of risk and a decreased intention for testing, which is good since testing isn't always appropriate. Genetic testing is associated with reduced breast cancer worry if it's negative, but increased anxiety, of course, if it's positive. They concluded that the overall harms of this process of counseling and testing were small to moderate. A number of national organizations, including ACOG, also recommend testing for these genes in and referral to a genetic counselor in alignment with the task force. So tools are provided in the task force report in a series of tables. So if you go to breastcancergenescreen.org, there's also a tool. It takes about 5 minutes, does this assessment of family history, and provides an estimate of the percent likelihood of risk. The task force says if the risk is more than 10%, you should refer. This breast cancer gene screen says if it's more than 5%, which also seems reasonable. It's completely confidential. They do ask for a name, I think, but that's mostly just a print on the report that the patient can then take to their doctor. So something that is implementable in practice, again, breastcancergenescreen.org. And remember, those patients who screen positive, don't just get the BRCA test, refer them for genetic counseling. Dave, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, my thoughts on this, Mark, are always the issue about, and I think this is relevant to docs out in practice, is are women really going to get shared decision-making, truly informed consent when they get the testing? And I think that's the key thing that we really need to be cautious about. I went back and I looked at some of the numbers on the treatment for this. If a woman has a bilateral, basically mastectomy done prophylactically to prevent breast cancer, her number needed to treat to prevent one case of breast cancer is 6. Number needed to treat to prevent one death from breast cancer is 25. The medications that are used, tamoxifen or loxifen, some of the other medicines, do decrease the risk of breast cancer death, but they also increase the risk of death from strokes and venous thrombotic events. As far as the same thing with prophylactic oophorectomy, the number needed to treat to prevent one case of cancer is about 36. The Cochrane Review on this estimates that these are all retrospective cohort studies, so the benefits may be overstated, mainly because the women who actually went through it were younger and healthier and probably more likely from a higher socioeconomic class, so they were going to do better. So the bottom line is, I think, you know, there is benefit, but it's incredibly important that women really get true shared decision-making. I worry sometimes doctors don't really give that number needed to treat, but they use more of a relative risk reduction, which sounds always a lot better. So again, I think it's important for family clinicians to check out what kind of genetic counseling really is occurring and whether it's really truly informed consent.
Great point. I think what I've seen is for oophorectomy and bilateral mastectomy that the likelihood of being diagnosed with breast cancer is going down more than 90%. And so with a baseline risk of 50 to 70% for those malignancies, depending on the specific mutation, I thought the NNT would be higher, but that might also have to do with how long these women were followed or other factors. Henry, any thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the tools that they provide are helpful in identifying women who are at higher risk. I share Dave's concerns about the trade-offs, particularly in women who may have other comorbid conditions that might guide their decision-making process. Really good genetics counselors can actually do some of this. I don't know how comprehensive they are in terms of taking into account all of the various factors. But the big question is, what do primary care clinicians do when you don't have easy access to those counselors? And what are the tools that we need to help to guide that first step before we even get them to the genetics counselors? And I think that's a gap in the literature and maybe a set of tools that the task force can help us. Because the task force has generally been very responsive to try to provide tools to make it easier for clinicians and patients. This is one that's lacking.
Good point. Henry, Dave, thank you. We're going to move on and talk. This is an Atrium Health Beats that Dave is going to do. Dave, tell us a little bit, remind us what the Beats are and what Beats stands for.
Okay, again, Beats stands for Best Evidence Alerts. And in general, what I try to do is look at interventions in medicine that we often take for granted, that we really may or may not recognize that the evidence is more or less supportive than we think. This week's Beats was about sitz baths. Now, I remember back as a medical student hearing regularly recommended that a patient have a sitz bath. I remember thinking, what is a sitz bath? I mean, is it different than a stand bath? But basically, obviously, I learned after a while it was sitz bath referred to where we recommend that somebody sits down mainly in a plastic tub. Turns out the sitz bath was first described in the medical literature in 1859, and we do commonly recommend it for various anal, rectal, and gynecological, urological problems. Without really letting people know what that is, or in the same situation like mine, they might just do a Google search or look on Amazon, and you can do that. You can go ahead and type in Amazon sitz bath, and it turns out they have about 100 different plastic devices that are there in multiple colors. The average plastic sitz bath contains about a pound and a half of plastic, and it holds water to a depth of 4 inches. Interestingly, the average perineum frequently cannot reach that water level, and there are actually many case reports of obese individuals who actually became stuck and had to get medical assistance to help them remove the sitz bath. So although the hot water does temporarily relax the internal anal sphincter, which does allow for some relief of spasm-related pain, most of the sitz baths don't have a fancy water temperature control device, and thus the water really doesn't remain hot for more than a few minutes. And interestingly, the best available evidence we have from a meta-analysis that was published in 2005 in the journal Diseases of the Colon and Rectum did not show any clinical value at all of the sitz bath compared to either no treatment or other more commonly prescribed treatments such as lidocaine, hydrocortisone, nitroglycerin ointment, or even fiber supplements for all of the same medically related conditions. So sitz baths are plastic. They're mainly contaminated after use. They're rarely recycled. Hospitals and other institutions likely end up throwing away hundreds and thousands of those, filling up landfills, filling up our rivers, and even creating those floating oceans. So again, for those of us out there, there's really minimal, if any, evidence of medical effectiveness to the sitz baths. So let's all do our part, save the oceans, save our planet, and recommend just a regular old hot tub bath, which at least has a guaranteed source of renewable hot water and is much less likely to entrap an obese perineum.
Well, and whenever I see sitz baths, it's spelled S-I-T-Z. Henry and I are both native German speakers, and I think, no, it's sitz bath, which is the German word for sitting. So when man sich hinsetzt. So I think that's where it comes from, actually, is from the German. Henry, do you have any insights into sitz bath?
I actually did look into this. I did look it up, and it is not named after Dr. Sitz. It is, in fact, based on the German. It was actually that 1859 report was, in fact, from Germany. It was very popular in Germany during that era. And I suspect that at that time they used porcelain or enamel-covered metal for those small bathtubs.
Interesting. I know there were lots of health trends in Germany when I was a kid. My mother's mother was a fanatic of Kneipp, Dr. Kneipp, who basically was a big fan of cold. So you cold showers, cold baths, taking the child outside in the cold. And I was in Montreal, so that was pretty easy to do. So we always used to tease my mom about that. Anyway, Henry, it is your turn for the quiz.
Yeah, so this month's quiz is based on a recent poem, one that we have not covered in the podcasts. It was a primary prevention study that took place in rural Iran. And what they did was they randomized patients to a poly pill or to a placebo. And it turns out that the poly pill was effective in reducing major adverse cardiac events after 5 years. Turns out that the number needed to treat was about 35. And it turns out that in rural Iran, this was a simple concoction that worked pretty well. The question is, which component of the poly pill is least likely to have prevented the major adverse cardiac events? A, hydrochlorothiazide, B, aspirin, C, atorvastatin, D, enalapril. Stay tuned.
We will. And while we're staying tuned, we can also listen to you tell us about your poem.
Oh, and this one I'm going to try to do with a straight face. This was published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology in July, and it asks the question, does fecal transplantation improve symptoms in patients with irritable bowel syndrome? We're not talking about C. difficile colitis. We're talking irritable bowel syndrome. The researchers did a really good job identifying multiple databases, trying to find randomized trials that compared fecal transplant with placebo in patients older than 16 years of age. They did lots of really good stuff. They actually tried to go through the bibliographies of conference proceedings and really dug. And with all of that yeoman's effort, they could identify, count them, 4 studies with only 254 patients. 2 of the studies had actually not even been fully published at the time and were only available in abstract form. All of them used the Rome criteria to establish the diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome. There was some variability in the way they administered the fecal material. One was transplant via colonoscopy. Another study used a nasojejunal tube, and 2 used oral capsules. Only one of the studies was considered to be at low risk of bias, and the authors reported that 3 were of uncertain risk. And my guess is that they probably were not high; that they were probably not high quality studies. Ironically, 2 of the studies reported that the patients on placebo did better than those that got the fecal transplant, and the other 2 studies showed global improvements. So when you pool the results, it turns out that they were completely diametrically opposed, no net effect. If you just looked at the 2 studies that showed global deterioration, they used the oral capsules. The number needed to harm was about 3. In the 2 studies where they found some improvement, it looked like the improvement was only during the first 12 weeks and that didn't continue afterwards. And, you know, the authors did a whole bunch of statistical jujitsu and subgroup analyses, but given the small number of patients and the small number of studies, that really seemed pretty silly. So, this study really pushed my patience and tested my ability to avoid scatology. But when you got a bunch of crappy studies and widely divergent results, it really is difficult to draw any conclusions at all. So stay tuned. If anything, at this point, avoid the oral capsules.
Yeah, it doesn't look like there's really much going on here. And, you know, it is effective, we think, for patients with persistent or recurrent C. diff. Not everybody with C. diff, but those who aren't responding to initial therapy or those who have recurrent, C. diff, it's a treatment option. But so far, I think there was also a study in Crohn's disease that showed maybe a small temporary effect, but doesn't look like irritable bowel. And yeah, I agree. Do a subgroup analysis when you have 4 little studies is like, come on.
Yeah, we know Henry is probably the best at helping us find those crap studies out there. I think, Mark, I saw the same thing you did. It may be that it helps with ulcerative colitis. I've heard there's been some early studies on actually obesity, that changing the fecal flora might actually help that. But in overall, It may be that it's the method, but it'll be interesting to see more research on this in the future.
So a fecal transplant from a skinny person would help me? Is that what you're saying? Give it a try. we were just talking about C. diff tangentially, and I just got back, and that's, we know that's one of the most important complications of inappropriate antibiotic use, or antibiotic use in general, appropriate or not. And I just got back. I was invited by the Infectious Disease Society of America to attend a workshop meeting that they had by invitation in D.C. to talk about antibiotic stewardship for respiratory infections in the outpatient setting, one of my favorite topics, something I'm currently doing research on. And there were 32 people at the meeting. I was the only primary care physician actually working in the outpatient setting. No other primary care docs, no actual pediatricians or internists. I think there might have been one ER doc, but they were actually an ID doc who worked in the ED, ID in the ED. So it was kind of funny that they thought of themselves as such experts. And as it turned out, they actually had a lot of misconceptions about what might work in the outpatient setting. It was a good meeting, though. I think we made some progress. Certainly more than half of the outpatient antibiotics for respiratory tract infection are inappropriate. And that's probably generous. It's probably closer to 60 or 70%. We routinely are using broad spectrum antibiotics when we shouldn't. You know, we shouldn't be using any for most of these patients, but when we do, we should be trying to use more narrow spectrum antibiotics. These antibiotics are routinely prescribed too long, 7-10 days, when 5 days typically suffices. UTI, not a respiratory infection, obviously, but asymptomatic bacteria, they just published a guideline. We should not be treating that unless the patient actually has systemic signs of infection or urinary symptoms, not just something like mental status change. We shouldn't be treating UTI with prolonged courses or generally with quinolone. So a lot that we can improve in both skilled nursing settings and outpatient settings and urgent care. One of the concerns expressed was that a lot more of these acute infections are moving to urgent care as primary care physicians get busier and busier and there are fewer of us. And urgent care has a different set of incentives at times, also doesn't have the longitudinal continuity with the patient, making their prescribing rates for antibiotics on average higher than in the primary care setting. So what can we do about this? So audit and feedback, if your health system or insurance company is doing audit and feedback, comparing you to your peers. And what seemed to be especially helpful was comparing you to the best prescribers in terms of who used the least antibiotics for respiratory infections. That seemed to have an effect. Unfortunately, the effect didn't persist once we stopped doing that audit and feedback. Education about how to communicate with patients. There's some modules that have been developed, online courses. Those seem to be effective. Delayed antibiotics. So telling a patient, here's a prescription. I'm going to write on it, do not fill beyond 2 weeks. Only take it if you're not feeling better in a few days or if you're starting to feel worse. Only about a third of those ever get filled based on a Cochrane review. The ID folks hate that idea. They're like, well, just don't prescribe. But, just telling doctors not to prescribe hasn't worked for 20 years. So I think the delayed antibiotics, are effective, and I do use them selectively. Patient satisfaction is not affected by whether or not patients get an antibiotic in most studies. What does seem to matter is whether the patient felt they got a good explanation and were carefully evaluated and understand, and that the doctor paid attention to them. That matters. I think telling patients how long they can expect the cough to last, which is on average about 2 weeks, is important so they understand what the typical course is with or without an antibiotic. And finally, John Hickner did some research on this, our friend John, who's not with us this week, but hopefully in a couple of weeks we'll be back. And he said, stop calling it acute bronchitis. He did a study, and calling it a chest cold led to greater acceptance of not getting an antibiotic. And if you think about it, acute means to patients really bad. And bronchitis to patients means that's something, I think those are in my lungs. So when you say acute bronchitis, you're telling a patient, you've got a really bad lung infection. And by the way, you don't need an antibiotic. And so no wonder they're unhappy. The British, others call these chest colds, which just sounds sort of cute and innocuous and much less threatening than acute bronchitis. So I've changed my language as well. And I think that, doing all of these things, I think over time can have an effect. And while we're talking about antibiotics, there was new guidelines from the IDSA and the American Thoracic Society on community-acquired pneumonia. The old ones were published in 2007, and for several years, their website has said, stay tuned, we're about to update them. Well, they finally did this month. Essentially, the duration of treatment, they say, should be at least five days, but if the patient's clinically stable at 5 days, stop the antibiotics. So not necessarily any more than 5 days as long as they're stable. For an outpatient with community-acquired pneumonia, no comorbidities and no risk factors for MRSA or Pseudomonas, they recommend amoxicillin, 1 gram TID, or doxycycline, 100 BID, or a macrolide, as long as pneumococcal resistance to macrolides is less than 25% in your community. For an outpatient with community-acquired pneumonia and comorbidities like heart, lung, liver, renal disease, diabetes, alcoholism, malignancy, asplenia, for those folks, they recommend one of two regimens, so either Augmentin or cefepodoxime or cefuroxime, so basically amoxiclav or a cephalosporin plus a macrolide or doxycycline. And the other alternative would be a respiratory fluoroquinolone for those patients, levofloxacin, moxifloxacin, or gemifloxacin. So that's hot off the presses, just came out. If you Google IDSA community acquired pneumonia guideline, it should pop right up, and you can review that. It's online for free. They have a number of other recommendations. Most of their focus is, even though it's community-acquired pneumonia, is around the more complicated patients in the hospital that they see. But there are some, you know, very clear and I think reasonable recommendations around antibiotics, and you know, that we don't have to put every single patient with pneumonia on Augmentin plus levofloxacin plus a macrolide.
Yeah, Mark, just one reminder there about the how long you expect a typical cough to last. Remember, I had that beats a couple of weeks ago about the risk of Teflon pearls. So, again, be cautious about prescribing those if there's little kids around.
That's right. They can be deadly for small children, even one or two, right, can be fatal. So good advice. And yeah, I think what we really need are, frankly, better symptomatic treatments for cough. You know, if it's going to last a couple of weeks, it's miserable. People are hesitant to give opiates. You know, I will still prescribe an opiate selectively for a short term, not giving a large amount. But, you know, there are, you know, the dextromethorphan, certainly Teflon, you've already talked about some of the dangers of that in children. We need better symptomatic treatment.
For those folks listening who might be part of research networks, the only trial that had a little bit of benefit was actually with oral naproxen. It was only with about 50 people, and that really needs to be repeated again.
That's right. And a lot of times in these, in the randomized trials, they've limited what patients could take, so they couldn't take other medications. So for example, you know, naproxen versus antibiotic, that would be maybe a good trial to do for chest cold. Henry, you got your quiz answer for us.
Yes. So just a reminder, which component of the poly pill is least likely to prevent major adverse cardiovascular events? A, hydrochlorothiazide, B, low-dose aspirin, C, atorvastatin, D, enalapril. Well, the correct answer is B. So you thought that the poly pill was dead. In 2017, a Cochrane review found 9 randomized trials with about 7,000 patients, and that review did not find any convincing evidence that the poly pill was effective for prevention and suggested larger trials with longer-term follow-up. So this rural Iranian study actually is a longer-term study with 3,400 participants. So when you take all of those ingredients together into a single pill, based on our recent reviews of the Esprit trial and the Aspire trial and all of these other aspirin prevention, it is probably the aspirin that is unlikely to make much of a difference. Now, this is a study that took place in a rural low to moderate income resource country. And so it's quite possible that these are unique to socioeconomic factors more so than the typical kinds of things that we tend to think about in terms of lipids and smoking status and the like.
Yeah, but this pill could be, you know, it's a dirt cheap, right? These ingredients. And I agree with the aspirin. It really depends on the setting. And I think we have to be cautious about extrapolating old data to the modern era. So we found that we're just, my colleague Frank Moriarty, Dr. Moriarty for you Sherlock Holmes fans, Dr. Moriarty and I, who's a pharmacologist and epidemiologist at RCSI and at the office next to me, we just are close to publishing a meta-analysis of the older aspirin data compared with these four newer studies. And like you said, the newer studies found much, much less benefit, no cancer prevention benefit anymore. And I think what's happened is that in the 70s and 80s, we weren't controlling hypertension, we weren't controlling lipids, we weren't addressing other risk factors, whereas now we're doing that. So there's just less potential benefit for aspirin. And we're also better at treating cardiovascular disease. So the potential benefit of aspirin has been really mitigated into, to nothing. And so we always have to think about what's the setting where we're studying these pills.
In the law of diminishing return that you talk about, Mark, that's really good stuff you're doing.
When the overall risk is lower, then any intervention is going to have less absolute benefit, I think.
That's a lot of the reason why we're not so sure that blood sugar control does as much anymore.
That's right. That's right. As we're controlling other cardiovascular risk factors. All right. So thanks for the discussion, guys. Hope everyone has enjoyed today's podcast. Tell your friends, rate us on iTunes. Even if you don't like us, rate us on iTunes. It gets us in front of more people. And we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.